Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
So just sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide, and say...
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
Are you awake? Whoa! Are you awake now?
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Say what?
Dear God, she's going to kill us all.
Welcome to the WKRP cast. My name is Donna Stair.
And I'm her husband, Alan. This is a week-by-week, episode-by-episode rewatch. We're getting into the music,
the trivia,
and the fun of WKRP.
So, fellow babies, don't touch that dial. It's time for the WKRP cast.
I'm at WKRP in Cincinnati.
Welcome back to another WKRP cast. We're getting Cold War paranoid today. What's our episode, Donna?
We are going to be discussing Secrets of Dayton Heights. The air date was February 28, 1981, written by John Smet. Story editor, Lisa Levin. Executive story consultants, Dan Gunselman and Steve Marshall. And it was directed by Frank Bonner.
Another Herb-directed episode.
Yeah.
Love seeing Frank getting into the directing thing, which is going to be the course of his career for years later.
Well, in this episode, Les is prepared to attend a presidential press conference, but finds his credentials are being questioned. The Secret Service have uncovered the fact his biological father was a communist.
The title of this one, Secrets of Dayton Heights, comes from a very obscure source. In December of 1980, CBS launched a primetime soap with a teen cast called Secrets of Midland Heights. This has to be a nod to that show. Midland Heights aired on Saturday nights at 10 p.m., 2 hours after WKRP. It only aired 7 times before it was canceled. It was on from December 6, 1980 until January 24th of 1981. Its highest ranking for a week was number 57. It was characterized as a teenage soap along the lines of Dallas or Dynasty. Secrets of Midland Heights was a huge bomb. It did feature a couple of notable appearances. There was a 13-year-old Melora Hardin, who would later become Jan Livingston Gould on The Office, and a pre-Falcon Crest Lorenzo Lamas.
And did you catch the name of our writer, John Smet, with no H in John, just J-O-N? We didn't believe he was real. It felt like a Raoul Plager situation. If you look up John Smet on IMDb, you'll find 3 of them. This one is listed as number 2. On his performer page is a single word, writer. He also only has a single credit, this episode of WKRP. We reached out to associate producer Max Tosh to see if he knew anything about the mysterious John Smet. Max said Smet is a real guy. He was a friend of one or more of the writers on the staff. John was either a stand-up comic or an improv performer and an aspiring writer. We don't know what he wound up doing, but the writing doesn't seem to have worked out for Mr. Smet.
Let's get into the episode. We start out in the studio where Les is on the mic doing his news report. Johnny and Venus are in the studio, and they appear to be working on wiring up some new equipment, which caused me to hold up a minute. Why are two DJs rewiring the board? My first thought was, where's Bucky Dornster? I'm a tinkerer and a solder jockey, so I've been scolded more than once by real engineers. As a DJ, you don't try to rewire equipment or fix anything in the station. If you do, you get in big trouble for it. I know.
And now a special look at this episode's bandage placement for the 5-time Buckeye NewsHawk Award winner, Les Nessman. This is the Les Nessman Bandage Report. Now, here's Donna Stair with her report about Les Nessman.
Left middle finger.
This has been a look at the bandage placement for Silver Sow and Copper Cob award-winning journalist Les Nessman.
Les is announcing the presidential press conference coming up next week.
From Washington, which, by the way, I'll be visiting next week in person for a presidential press conference. An honor, by the way, which has not been granted to many reporters outside of the Washington press corps.
Les is grinning as he turns to look at Venus and Johnny, making sure they heard this.
Now, let's take a look at Venus's vibin' threads. Venus is wearing a shiny gold windbreaker jacket with a purple shirt underneath with gold lettering that spells out Cincinnati Tech. He has a gold and black scarf tied around his neck and is wearing blue pants with a shiny black belt. Les continues his report about the new Secretary of Agriculture, John Block. Les is proud to announce Block is a hog farmer.
Announce that President Reagan...
Reagan.
Who, by the way, is a rancher, would be making a farm subsidy announcement as soon as he studies the subsidy study. This is Les Nessman saying this is Les Nessman.
Les reaches for a control button and panics when he can't find it. He begins shoving wires and things out of the way as Johnny and Venus are yelling for him to not touch anything.
Where's the button? Hey, don't touch anything.
Call the wires.
Les,
no, don't touch the button.
Les, listen.
News Beacon, the Ohio Valley reporting.
It's insanity, and it's insanity going out over the air. So the president Les mispronounced is, of course, Ronald Wilson Reagan, the 40th president of the United States. The Gipper was sworn in only about a month before this episode aired, so we can understand if Les still isn't totally solid on the pronunciation.
John Block was an Illinois hog farmer born in Galesburg, Illinois in 1935. The home where Block grew up was so rural, it didn't have electricity. He served as Secretary of Agriculture under Ronald Reagan from 1981 until 1986. Block's tenure as Secretary of Agriculture saw the closure of more family farms in the U.S. than at any other time since the Great Depression. Block is currently 86 years old. He has three children with his first wife. He is currently living with his second wife in Dunn-Loring, Virginia.
Les seems to be pitting farmers versus ranchers with some of his remarks. This has been an ongoing dispute for decades, especially in the American West. It was even spoofed in the tune "The Farmer and the Cowman Should Be Friends" from the musical Oklahoma.
The farmer and the cowman should be friends. Oh, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. One man likes to push a plow, the other likes to chase a cow, but that's no reason why they can't be friends.
Yeehaw!
Farmers and ranchers use land and water resources in very different ways. In the days before barbed wire, a herd of cattle searching for grazing land could easily wipe out a very expensive crop.
Les keeps fighting with the cart machine as Johnny hurries over to put a record on the turntable. Suddenly, they all hear the intro to one of Les's commentaries.
And now, a Les Nessman commentary.
Do you mind?
Cincinnati's award winner offers his perspective on the events that shape our world, our community, and our lives.
This seems to be what Les was trying to get to play. He pushes Johnny out of the chair and gets back behind the mic. He starts into a weird film noir-sounding monologue.
America? Who was that lady I saw you with last night? Could it have been the sweet seductress known as the Communist Conspiracy? Was it she who stood under the streetlight luring the farm boys with her broad shoulders? Beware!
This is some weird stuff, even for Les.
With her broad shoulders. So Andy also seems to find this a little weird. Les is interrupted by Andy banging on the studio window and making the cut sign by drawing his pointer finger across his neck. Andy doesn't look happy. He motions for Les to come out in the hall. Les has to give some closure to his remarks, so he shouts,
"Think about it! This is Les Nessman!"
Les then jumps up and heads out the studio door. Johnny, once again, has to jump behind the mic with no warning. He introduces Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs.
The MGs was the nickname for the Memphis group. They were the in-house band for Stax Records. Booker T was Booker T Jones. He was keyboardist for the MGs. The rest of the MGs were Al Jackson on drums, Louis Steinberg on bass, and Steve Cropper on guitar. Green Onions was based on a Jones 12-bar blues riff. The group was looking for a flip side to another Jones-composed tune, Behave Yourself. Jones pulled out the riff during a session, and the rest of the MGs fell into the groove. Much of the track was improvised during recording.
After disc jockeys started to get requests for the instrumental on the flip side of Behave Yourself, it was reissued as its own single. Green Onions would peak at number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100. It is number 181 on the Rolling Stone list of the 500 greatest songs of all time, and it is the only instrumental on that list. A fun tidbit, Jones originally wanted to call the song Funky Onions. The wife of Stax owner Jim Stewart thought Funky Onions sounded like a swear word, so it got changed.
So we're in the hallway outside the studio, and we've got a poster watch.
Yay!
The big poster on the door leading into the bullpen is a promo poster for Randy Meisner's second solo album, One More Song. In the 70s, Meisner had been a vocalist and a founding member of both Poco and the Eagles. He sang and played bass on the Eagles' first 5 albums. He also wrote and sang their first million-selling hit, Take It to the Limit. When he left the group in September of 1977, his high harmonies were taken over by Poco frontman Timothy B. Schmidt. Weirdly, Schmidt had also taken over for Meisner when he left Poco in 1971 to go form the Eagles.
It's almost like there would not have been soft rock in the 70s if it hadn't been for Randy Meisner and Timothy B. Schmidt.
Yeah.
So this album would prove to be Meisner's biggest solo disc. It included the hit Hearts on Fire.
I've been aching from desire. Her blood's running like a raging river, and her heart's on fire.
Hearts on Fire peaked at number 19 on the Hot 100 in 1981. This album was produced just after the Eagles broke up the first time. Amazingly, it includes vocals by both Glenn Frey and Don Henley on the track One More Song. They weren't speaking to each other at the time and recorded their parts separately. This oversized promo poster is somewhat rare. You can currently get one on eBay for about $50.
Behind Les's head, to Andy's left, are two posters. The poster on the left is for Ry Cooder and Band in concert. It's promoting the concert tour supporting his October 1980 album, On the Border. Ryland Peter Cooder is an American musician, writer, poet, film score composer, and record producer, among other things.
He is quite the Renaissance man.
The cover art for this album and the art on this poster is an illustration from Carlos Rono Iopis. It's one of a bull and a naked female bullfighter with her back to the viewer. WKRP has covered over the naked bullfighter's backside with a Blues Brothers poster. This in-concert promo is a rare poster. A recent copy offered on eBay went for just over $100. And I think bullfighting without a top on, not a good idea.
She's also in high heels. She's entirely naked. She's entirely naked
in high heels. Okay.
And I found the poster doing a search Googling for this and was a little surprised.
You know, they always say something you should not do naked is fry bacon. Well,
yeah,
you can add this to it.
Bullfighting makes the list, yep. To the right of the Ry Cooder poster, you can just get a glimpse of the corner of a poster promoting the Blues Brothers' third album called Made in America. This was their second live album, which was released in December of 1980. It was an attempt to capitalize on the success of their movie. It was a short little thing, as albums go. The entire album clocked in at just under 34 minutes. Here's a fun little tie back to Johnny's show. There is a version of Green Onions on this album, and the guitar player on the cut is Steve Cropper from the original MGs. It also includes MGs bassist Donald Duck Dunn. Dunn was not an original. He took over for original MGs member and bassist Louis Steinberg in 1965.
So we left off where Andy knocked on the window and motioned for Les to come out into the hallway. Les quickly goes out into the hallway and walks to the door leading to the bullpen as Andy calls his name. Les opens the door, saying hi to Andy, and goes into the bullpen, closing the door behind him and holding it shut so Andy can't get in. From the other side of the door, we hear Les ask Andy if he's going to yell at him.
Of course not, Les. I don't yell. I'm an easygoing guy with a natural ability to lead. People just seem to want to do what I tell them.
All right. Now, doesn't Andy's line seem a little bit rehearsed?
A little bit, yes.
I think he's used this one before.
The door opens a crack, and Les slowly comes into the hallway to face Andy.
Les gives a nervous little giggle as Andy puts his hand on Les's shoulder and starts to speak. Les is not happy about this. He looks at Andy's hand. Andy removes his hand from Les's shoulder.
Thank you, Andy.
Andy tells Les he's not there to talk about his commentary.
Matter of fact, I won't even mention it beyond saying if you ever do it again, I will yell at you severely.
He's not happy about the commentary, but that's not what he's there to talk about. Andy tells Les he wants to talk to him about his trip to Washington for the presidential press conference. Andy says they've run into a snag.
Mr. Carlson said I could go. He even suggested I spend the whole week there.
Well, Andy's on board with the trip, and he explains it was his idea for Les to stay a whole week in Washington. He tells him the snag is not on WKRP's end.
The White House press office called me and told me they're going to hold your credentials. The Secret Service seems to have the impression that you might pose some sort of threat. It's crazy, isn't it?
It's because I work for a rock and roll station, isn't it?
Les asks Andy, doesn't the White House know who he is? Doesn't he have a reputation? We see the light in the hallway flicker, and we hear Green Onions speed up where it sounds like the Chipmunks are playing. And as the light in the hallway fizzles out, the music stops completely.
Having DJs rewiring the board, that's what you get. So Les was denied admission to the press conference by the Secret Service. Just having the word secret in the name makes these guys a little menacing. They were an arm of the U.S. Treasury Department up until 2003. At that time, the Secret Service was placed under the Department of Homeland Security. The Secret Service has two tasks: protect U.S. heads of state, and prevent the counterfeiting of U.S. currency. The service was formed in 1865 in the wake of the Civil War. They were originally formed to stop counterfeiting. Currency was being widely counterfeited following the Civil War. The Secret Service was tasked with protecting our financial infrastructure.
The Secret Service is also tasked with ensuring the safety of the President of the United States, Vice President, and the President and Vice President elects. They also protect their immediate families, former presidents, spouses, minor children under the age of 16, major candidates, and foreign heads of state. The Secret Service quite famously will take a bullet for the president. Thankfully, in the long history of the service, only one agent has ever been shot while doing this duty. About a month after this episode aired, on March 30th of 1981, Agent Tim McCarthy took a round in the right chest from John Hinckley while protecting President Ronald Reagan. The bullet damaged his right lung, diaphragm, and the right lobe of his liver. McCarthy, who's from Chicago, recovered fully and went on to become the chief of police in Orland Park, Illinois, in May of 1994.
Yeah, when you're from Chicago, you get shot, you just keep going. That was McCarthy's thing. He was tough. And the giant spot under the on-air light in the studio hallway is an oversized poster promoting the Eagles' 1980 live double album. And wow, those posters in that spot are always huge. The bitterness practically drips from this one. The Eagles had broken up at the end of the Long Run tour in July of 1980. Glenn Frey and Don Henley nearly came to blows backstage after that last show. The band owed Elektra Asylum one more album in order to fulfill their contractual obligation. This is how you squeeze one more album out of a band who can't stand each other. Live draws from performances recorded in both 1976 and 1980, so we hear both Randy Meisner and Timothy B. Schmidt performances. Most of the cuts are from the Hotel California and Long Run tours.
The live songs were overdubbed in order to correct harmonies. Frey did his parts in Los Angeles. The rest of the band was in Miami. Bill Sismic, sound engineer on the project, said they were fixing three-part harmonies, courtesy of Federal Express. The huge number of fixes was apparent. Rolling Stone magazine called it the most overdubbed live album ever made. One new song was included, the harmony-heavy Seven Bridges Road.
There is a taste of time, sweet. Down the Seven Bridges Road.
I love that one.
That's a good song.
The Steve Young cover had been a concert warm-up tune for the band for many years. It was the only single from Live. The album went to number 6 on the U.S. album charts. Seven Bridges Road peaked at number 21 on the Hot 100. Both would be the last chart entries for the band until they reformed in 1994.
Now, if you remember, the light in the hallway had just fizzled out and the music came to a stop. The door to the studio opens. Venus staggers out in a cloud of smoke. He's coughing as he slams the door shut behind him, and this cracked me up. He doesn't say a word. He just runs at full steam down the hallway. Andy and Les watch as he disappears. Then the studio door opens again, and now Johnny comes out. Johnny's holding a screwdriver by the blade, not looking too upset. He just looks from Andy to Les and says,
"You guys know where the fire extinguisher is?"
So as we wait for the smoke to clear, we head into our theme.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
We come back to the lobby where Bailey and Jennifer are having girl talk over an open drawer from the filing cabinet.
That's when he promised me the dream trip to Paris in April. Oh, Paris in spring. That's why I want to surprise him. Would you help me brush up on my French?
Bailey agrees to help Jennifer. They go over to Jennifer's desk where she has what she considers to be key phrases written down on a notepad.
Now, pay attention. Jennifer's most important French phrases set up a great but kind of subtle runner throughout the episode. They are so very specific to Jennifer's situation, but if you picture Jennifer's usual dates, these phrases are hilarious.
Herb enters saying good morning to them.
Not now, Herb.
Poor Herb.
Yeah, Herb just gets slapped around all the time. Bailey picks up the notepad and reads the first phrase to Jennifer.
Thank you for a lovely evening. Merci beaucoup pour un soir parfait.
Herb looks through the messages he was reading and stares at Jennifer.
Have you forgotten to take your heart pills? Oh, Jennifer. Avez-vous oublié à prendre votre médecine du cœur?
Good, that's good.
Might come in handy.
Please don't spoil this special evening with such suggestions.
They're getting weird real fast. Herb begins laughing as Bailey and Jennifer glare at him.
I'm too busy to parley-voo around her anyway.
Herb heads over to Carlson's office, but Jennifer stops him.
No, Herb.
Herb asks her why. Jennifer explains that Mr. Carlson is having a very private meeting.
And he told me not to let just anyone else in.
Herb asks who's in the office. Bailey tells him Andy, Les, and Mr. Carlson. Herb puts his ear to Mr. Carlson's door. He asks if they know what's being discussed in the meeting.
Well, not exactly, but I'm pretty sure it's not a meeting to bring in some gung-ho guy in sales to sell this station the way it should be sold.
Herb nervously starts heading for the door leading to the bullpen.
If anybody asks, tell them I'll be out on sales calls all day long and, I probably won't be back till very, very late.
And that's it for Herb in this entire episode. With Herb out making sales calls, Frank Bonner is left to take care of other things like, you know, directing the episode.
Monsieur L, il est très stupide.
Oui, oui.
Herb leaves the lobby.
Yeah, they're not hiring a new sales guy. That's not what's going on. We do cut into Carlson's office to this very private meeting. Art's seated behind his desk. Les and Andy are standing to the side. Art, in true Carlson fashion, doesn't want to be involved with any of this.
Does this have to involve me? I mean, right at this moment.
Andy tells Carlson, it does.
Now, what has happened, to put this in a nutshell, no offense, Les, is the WKRP will not be represented at the presidential press conference next week.
Art thanks them for letting him know, and he bends down to be face-to-face with Carlson, who obviously is not getting the gravity of the situation.
The Secret Service has refused our newsman because they say he poses some possible threat.
Well, Carlson scoffs at this.
Threat? To who?
Huh. They're afraid of a little honest journalism. They know me for the hard-hitting, bare-knuckle kind of guy I am.
Mr. Carlson apologizes to Les and suggests they'll send him somewhere else for a week or two.
Say a farm community with a fast-breaking livestock scandal.
Wow, they are really wanting to get rid of Les for a week
it
or so, aren't they?
Sounds like it. Andy tells Mr. Carlson that Les has a right to find out why he's been turned down by the Secret Service. It might be a mistake.
They're afraid of me. Afraid of my mind.
Andy wants to go down to the federal building to get to the bottom of this thing.
And I think a show of support from his employer would be very helpful, sir.
Art tells Travis he's on the right track. Nobody is going to get away with pushing one of their reporters around. Not without a fight.
Well, you just go on and take the rest of the afternoon if it's necessary. And if you have to call in the big artillery, you know where to find them.
Art picks up his magazine and begins reading.
As I was saying, in the words of Hal Holbrook, when he was playing the part of Mark Twain, let's go.
Art's beaten. He gets up, tosses his magazine on his desk, and heads out.
Les mentioned Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain. It is almost hard to separate the two. Amazingly, Hal Holbrook began portraying Mark Twain all the way back in 1954. He wrote a one-man stage play based on the writings and speeches of Twain. He edited and arranged the various pieces as if Twain were conducting a lecture in the 1890s. Holbrook's original script was expanded to include other Twain passages.
I miss my home and family and my fireside and the cats. I like cats. They're quieter than children. I like everything about cats except their singing voices. We have one, a Presbyterian soprano.
Holbrook eventually started to alternate the material he performed at each show. A program listing all of the possible segments that he might do would be provided. Holbrook would then select the specific pieces he did on any particular night. Holbrook portrayed Twain both on and off Broadway for 63 years throughout the United States and around the world.
Wow.
Yeah, an amazing career. When he abruptly retired from performing as Mark Twain in 2017, Holbrook remarked he had used the name longer than Samuel Clemens. Clemens adopted the pen name at age 24, and he used it until his death at age 74. So that was a mere 50 years where he was Mark Twain. Hal Holbrook had 63 years performing as Mark Twain.
We transition into the lobby where Jennifer and Bailey continue practicing French phrases.
I have my passport, my ticket, and my own money, so don't threaten me.
Andy, Les, and Mr. Carlson come out of Carlson's office. Carlson is wearing his overcoat and his hat is in his hand. Andy's telling Mr. Carlson he's doing the right thing. He'll thank himself when it's all over with. Andy and Les head off to get their coats.
You're not going to wear jeans, are you?
Mr. Carlson tells Jennifer he'll be out of the office for a while, and he apologizes to Jennifer and Bailey for the secrecy. But they didn't want to embarrass Les before it was necessary. Bailey and Jennifer are looking at small books full of French phrases. Neither of them is really paying attention to Mr. Carlson. Well, Jennifer adds some uh-huhs in the right places.
Andy and Les return to the lobby with their coats.
Dungarees are for the farm.
Fine. That's okay for me. Let's get it.
And although the suits versus dungarees days are over, Les cannot get on board with blue jeans.
They're just not proper. They're for the farm. So Andy, Les, and Art all head out the door.
Andy, the insurance company called. They need an estimate on the damage caused by the fire.
Art quickly comes back into view.
What fire?
Jennifer immediately open their little books and start reading again. And okay, hold on a minute. Did you see what Andy put on his head as he headed out the door?
Yes, is he going to be in Oliver or
the
something?
Cast of Newsies? He's going to be a newsie.
Please, sir, I want some more.
You got the pickpocket or two. You got the pickpocket or two, boys.
You got the pickpocket or two.
Okay, now we transition to a little office where a man wearing sunglasses is sitting behind a desk. His door identifies the office as Treasury Department. The door opens and Andy comes in.
Excuse me, sir. Looking for the branch office of the Secret Service.
Just a minute.
And hey, look who it is. It's our old friend Sam Anderson. And I love Sam and the sunglasses. Those are a hilarious touch. It's just that one little prop, and it tells us how gung-ho our Secret Service agent is.
The agent is engrossed in the file on his desk.
Art and Les come in behind Andy. Art asks if this is it or not. Andy tells him to hold on just a minute. The agent stands up and puts the file he'd been reading into a drawer. Then he turns to Andy.
Now, can I help you?
Not going to rush this guy. Andy tells Berwick the building directory says this is the room, but it says Treasury Department on the door.
You see, the Secret Service is part of the Treasury Department, but very few people seem to know that.
I knew it.
And we remember from our little information earlier about Secret Service, that's not true anymore. The Secret Service is now part of Homeland Security.
The Secret Service agent is, of course, our old buddy Sam Anderson, back for his third appearance on WKRP in an entirely new part. We first met Sam in Season 1's Johnny Comes Back. He was nervous interviewee Mason Noble.
Hey, Andy. Mason Noble. Hey, glad to see you. Glad to be seen by you. Glad to be glad. Hey.
In Season 2, Sam had a memorable turn as immigration officer Mr. Anderson in The Americanization of Ivan.
You can't defect here. No. See, there are a lot of things that you can't do in Cincinnati. And that's one of them.
Sam will be back once more in Season 4. Some fun Sam facts. He's originally from Wahpeton, North Dakota, and during the 1970s, he taught drama at Antelope Valley College in Lancaster, California.
Andy introduces the three of them. He and Art put out their hands for a formal handshake. Berwick don't play that. He does not offer his hand back. Andy and Art both reach up and scratch their necks at the same time, doing that thing you do, you know, when you get denied on the handshake. Andy asks the man for his name. Berwick flashes his ID as he introduces himself.
Special Agent Berwick.
Man, is he serious. Andy asks Berwick if he's familiar with their station.
Is it here in town?
So, no.
I guess not.
Yeah, Andy tells him, yeah, it is. Berwick motions for them all to have a seat.
Berwick doesn't look like a rock and roll kind of guy.
No, I don't think he would be into the KRP format.
Andy begins to explain.
The Washington office said you might be able to help us here.
Berwick takes his glasses off and looks at Andy.
D.C.?
It is only two letters, but that pause. Washington, the beat, and then D.C. It was an honorable mention in my mind for line of the episode, even though it is only two letters.
Andy nods and says yes. Andy tells Berwick they are there to find out why WKRP's newsman's credentials were held up for President Reagan's press conference. As Andy is speaking, Carlson has picked up a pair of binoculars from the agent's desk, and he's looking at them.
You people are afraid of me.
Andy goes on to defend Les.
Les Nessman here is no threat to anyone. We stand by him. We vouch for him. Mr. Carlson?
Carlson has the binoculars up to his eyes now.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly how we feel, and by golly, thank you for your time.
No, we're not doing that.
Carlson stands to leave.
Carlson just loves toys on the desk.
He's fidgety.
So Andy tells him to sit back down. Andy tells the agent they'd like to get to the bottom of this.
Sure you would. It's a serious matter.
Berwick stands and heads over to the filing cabinet as he speaks.
A lot of people think we get a little carried away in our security measures.
Berwick stops suddenly and he turns to look at Les.
Nessman?
Uh-oh. That's recognition. Berwick pulls out a thick file folder and walks back over to his desk. He's looking at Les suspiciously as he does so.
A.K.A. the news beacon of the Ohio Valley.
Ooh.
Les is impressed to know this folder exists.
Berwick sits, opens the file folder, and looks at them.
Well, here it is.
Here, what is?
It's your radical affiliations, Mr. Nessman.
What radical affiliations?
Well, I am a member of the Hoedown Square Dancing Club.
Berwick shakes his head.
Those Hoedown Square Dancers are pretty subversive.
No, I'm talking about your father.
Daddy?
Twice accused of selling government secrets.
Les sits up straight and tells Agent Berwick his father ran a laundromat in Dayton, Ohio. Berwick tells them, according to the file, he was also a barber at the Pentagon. Which brings us to
the line of the episode.
Which Pentagon?
You know, there are so many.
There are so many Pentagons around.
As well as a proven card-carrying communist.
Communist?
We're pretty sure the Pentagon being mentioned is the one just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. It's home to the U.S. Department of Defense. The Pentagon was built during World War II. It was begun in September of 1941 and dedicated in January of 1943. The Pentagon is the largest office building in the world. It covers a total of 150 acres with 85 acres devoted to offices. That is a whopping 3.7 million square feet. The Pentagon is 5 stories above ground, 2 below. There are 5 ring corridors on each floor. If you total it up, the Pentagon houses 17 and a half miles of corridors.
Wow.
Just over 26,000 people work in the Pentagon. Even though it is located in Virginia, the building has 6 Washington, D.C. zip codes.
In the first half of the 20th century, being a card-carrying communist wasn't that big a deal. The Communist Party USA, or CPUSA, was formed in 1919. It split off from the U.S. Socialist Party. The Communist Party USA played a major role in the labor movement from the 1920s through the 40s. The party opposed racism and racial segregation. It wasn't until World War II, the beginning of the Cold War, and the new Red Scare of McCarthyism that the Communist Party fell into disfavor. During the 60s, the CPUSA broke bad.
They were heavily funded by the Soviet Union. The CPUSA became alienated from the U.S. political left. Beginning in the 1960s, CPUSA policies mirrored those of Moscow. After Glasnost and Perestroika in the 1980s caused the breakup of the Soviet Union, Soviet funding for the CPUSA ended in 1989. The Communist Party USA stopped fielding candidates after the breakup of the Soviet Union. They used to run a candidate every time we had an election here in the United States. The CPUSA just announced in April of 2021 it would once again be running political candidates after a hiatus of more than 30 years.
Agent Berwick saying that Les's father was a communist? Well, Les couldn't believe it.
Well, obviously you have the wrong news beacon.
Les tosses his hat onto the agent's desk.
And it don't rain in Indianapolis in the summertime.
So Special Agent Berwick is quoting lyrics from the song Little Green Apples, written by Bobby Russell. It was originally recorded by Roger Miller in 1968. Russell says he'd written the song with Miller in mind. It would give Miller a number 6 country and western hit, plus it would cross over to peak at number 39 on the Billboard Hot 100. Later that same year, O.C. Smith's version of Little Green Apples would go to number 2 on the Hot 100.
Oh, God didn't make little green apples. It don't rain in Indianapolis in the summertime. There's no such thing as Dr. Seuss, Disneyland, Mother Goose is no nursery rhyme.
It probably would have been a number 1 hit had it been released just a few weeks later. It was unable to dislodge the number 1 song at the time, Hey Jude, by the Beatles. And we were talking about the fact if Little Green Apples knocked Hey Jude
if that knocked Hey Jude out,
something wrong with the buying
public. I think
the world
would have stopped turning.
Yeah.
A concerned Carlson leans over to Andy.
We're not doing too good, are we, Andy?
Andy rolls his eyes as Les laughs us into a commercial break.
So we fade back up. Coming back from commercial, we're still in Agent Berwick's office, and Les is still laughing with disbelief as he looks at Agent Berwick. Andy's eyes are moving back and forth between Berwick and Les.
Les, there's nothing funny about this.
I know. And I don't want to hear any more bogus information about Daddy. Excuse me.
Les stands up to leave. He's done with this. Andy tries to stop Les from leaving.
I have to get back to work, Andy. After which, Special Agent Berwick, I'll be writing a rather fiery letter to my congressman.
Andy tells Mr. Carlson he'll see him back at the station. He runs after Les.
Well, Mr. Carlson stands up calling after Andy, but the door shuts in his face. Carlson turns to Agent Berwick.
I hope you can back up your accusations, Mr. Berkhouse.
It's Berwick.
Mr. Carlson is coming to Les's defense.
It is inconceivable to me that Les Nessman's father was a communist.
Was? Is.
Uh-huh. Well, now, you see, now that proves that this thing is full of mistakes because his father died 3 years ago. I went to the funeral. Every laundromat manager in Dayton was at that thing.
No, that was his stepfather. I'm talking about his real father.
Mr. Carlson has about had it. He's losing his temper.
Frankly, I don't know what you're talking about, mister, but I can tell you this. That kid is no more of a radical communist threat than I am.
Agent Berwick looks at Carlson suspiciously, then picking up his pencil, he asks,
your name is Trump?
Now, wait.
Andy Trump?
Carlson nods his head.
All right, let's do a quick age check. The kid Carlson was referring to had actually turned 40 the previous August. Richard Sanders was also only about 8 years younger than Gordon Jump. Now we're in the lobby where Jennifer's at her desk still working on her French when the phone rings. She picks up the receiver and puts it to her ear.
Bonjour, WKRP. Monsieur Carlson, il n'est pas ici, il visite ses parents en Amérique. Alors?
Shrugging her shoulders, Jennifer hangs up the phone. Johnny and Venus come into the lobby, and they're arguing.
Take some blame for it.
Well, I'm not either.
Well, I'm not going to pay for it.
Well, I'm not going to pay for it either.
Johnny goes over to the coffee machine to fill his mug.
You said you were an electrical engineer.
No, I said I dated an electrical
engineer. Jennifer, do you know that man almost single-handedly destroyed a control booth, and he won't even take the rap?
Jennifer looks up from her French book.
Je ne parle pas anglais.
See, I'm not.
Frustrated, Venus walks out of the lobby, followed by Johnny.
Art enters the lobby and asks Jennifer if Andy and Les are back yet.
Oui.
Jennifer is totally in French mode. Carlson asks Jennifer to tell them to come to his office.
No, on second thought, just tell Les. No, just call them both. We had time to get in here.
Art opens the door to his office, and he goes in to find Les and Andy are already there. Andy is yelling at Les.
Les, you can't continue to go off half-cocked like this. Now, Mr. Carlson, I'm still pretty shook up. Now, I told him we have a legal recourse in this matter.
Carlson looks at Andy and asks him to leave the office. He says this is a private matter.
Andy's confused.
Leave? Me?
He's looking around from Les to Mr. Carlson. Carlson continues to just look at Andy. Andy's stumped.
Well, I attend all the meetings.
Carlson walks over and opens his office door, motioning for Andy to go. Andy walks out the door, head lowered, looking dejected. Carlson closes the door and turns to Les.
Les, you're pretty close to your mother, aren't you?
Yes, of course. Everybody should be.
Carlson asks Les if he ever talked to his mother about his dad.
Mother's told me on numerous occasions how Daddy was planning to build an empire on the 25-cent unlimited dry.
Art stammers a bit, asking Les to please sit down. Les sits in Mr. Carlson's chair. Art tells Les he talked with Agent Burhouse.
Berwick.
Yeah, Berwick. After he and Andy left.
Which, there's no way to tell you this, Les, except straight out. Les, your father, he's alive.
Well, he's buried.
I'm not talking about Lester Nessman Sr. I've seen all the papers. I've seen the birth certificate, the hearing transcripts, the IRS report.
I don't think Les stands up and tries to leave.
Reports. I don't think I want to hear any more of this.
Carlson grabs Les by the arm.
Your father's real name is Harvey Morehouse. He's communist, or was. He divorced your mother just about the time you were born.
Carlson goes on to say the Secret Service assumes Les knew all of this. His birth father is his radical affiliation. Les is in shock.
Mother hates divorce. She hates it, just like she hates communism. She always told me that communists are unreliable.
You can see in his face, Les suddenly realizes his mother was referring to his dad.
Art picks up the phone from his desk and he moves it closer to Les, telling Les to call his mother.
Call your mother right now and ask her.
Les slowly walks back towards Art's desk and the phone. He looks at Art.
Can you stay with me while I think about it?
Les sits back down in Mr. Carlson's chair. Art puts a hand on Les's shoulder.
Wow, this scene really brought out the acting chops in both of these guys, but especially Richard Sanders.
Now, Richard Sanders sometimes gets hit with the overacting tag. I really think this was very constrained.
You can see that his years of stage training really came through here. His controlled but visible emotion, along with the slow realization about his personal history, it makes for a masterful performance.
Yeah, and it really just was jaw-dropping. I mean, once we got into this, you were just locked in. No laughs, but man, are you mesmerized.
You really feel for Les.
We cut out to the lobby where Bailey is sitting at Jennifer's desk eating a sandwich.
Please stop pouting. It's depressing.
The camera moves over to the chairs where we can only see Andy's legs. He is sitting in the nearest chair, the most downstage chair, leaning with his back against the wall, so his face is completely hidden.
I'm not pouting. And it wasn't you who was kicked out of his office so they could have their private meeting.
Bailey gets up and walks over to Andy.
Andy. You are thought of as an easygoing guy with a natural ability to lead. People seem to want to do what you tell them to do.
Bailey pinches Andy's cheek as she says this.
Now, here's a callback to the line Andy said earlier. This has to be something Andy's been repeating around the station.
Yeah, because she said it word for word,
right.
Exactly the way he said it outside the door.
The door to Mr. Carlson's office opens and Carlson comes out, quietly closing the door behind him. He lets out a big breath.
Get everything straightened out in there?
Andy picked up a magazine as if he was reading it, trying to look uninterested. Carlson tells him he guesses so. He says Les is on the phone.
You know how these things go.
Not firsthand.
Wow, has Andy's ego been bruised.
He never gets thrown out of meetings. We transition now to a place we've never been before, Harvey's Barber Shop. Les is walking up to the entrance to Harvey's. A sign in the window lets us know Harvey is open. Les walks in. There's a man stropping a blade, whistling along to After You've Gone by Tommy Dorsey, which is playing on the radio.
According to the master spreadsheet prepared by Michael Hernandez, the accountant of rock, This is Tommy Dorsey's version of After You've Gone. It's an old song. It was written in 1918, lyrics by Henry Creamer. Music composed by Turner Layton. A lot of performers have had a hit with this song, more than 40 of them, but not Tommy Dorsey. Dorsey definitely did it, but his version was only released as a B-side, twice, as far as we can tell. It was the flip to Canadian Capers in 1939, then again as the back to Embraceable You in 1946. We think this particular version wound up on WKRP because this is also the version of After You've Gone that appeared on the 1973 soundtrack for the movie Paper Moon.
The barber sees Les walk in and says,
"Hi."
He turns the music off and looks around at Les.
"Yeah, I'm not going to get rich off you, am I?"
Harvey Morehouse is being played by Bill McLane. Bill McLane has one of those everyman faces. It has served him well in his career. Born in June of 1917, Bill racked up 157 performer credits between 1948 and 1987. His 40-year career included mostly TV appearances, but he did start out in the movies. Between 1948 and 54, Bill appeared in 24 movies. Every single one of them, he was uncredited. He was a background POW in 1953's Stalag 17. He had parts like Caddy, Bellhop, and Counterman, all uncredited.
In 1954, he got his first TV part on a Playhouse serial called Studio 57. From there on, most of Bill's credits would be on TV, either as a series guest star or in a number of made-for-TV movies. Bill has what's called a versatile look. He appeared on Ozzie and Harriet 12 times as 12 different characters. Same with Chico and the Man. He had 9 appearances there in 9 different roles. Bill's last credited role was on Growing Pains in 1987. Bill died at his home in Los Angeles in 1994 at the age of 77.
Les is not smiling as he stares at Harvey. Harvey feels the need to explain the not gonna get rich off you joke. It's kind of uncomfortable.
There's not too much to cut there.
Les is stone-faced. He's completely unresponsive, just staring at Harvey.
You here for a haircut or a seance?
Harvey waves his hand in front of Les's face. Les tells him he'll have a haircut, then hangs his hat and coat on the rack by the door. He sits in the chair and takes off his glasses.
Just a trim.
Sure glad you didn't order a flat top.
Les asks him if he's Harvey Morehouse.
You heard of my sense of humor, huh? Glad to meet you, Mr.
Nessman. Les Nessman.
Harvey begins chit-chatting about how no one wants haircuts anymore. They all want styled and curled. Well, Les interrupts Harvey, asking him if the name Nessman means anything to him.
Why, should it? You somebody important?
Les then asks Harvey what his feelings are about politics.
Harvey tells him he sure likes to jump around in his conversation. Harvey stops combing Les's hair, thinking.
Nessman! Wait a minute. Wasn't there a Nessman with the Reds back in the mid-50s?
The Reds?
Yeah. Second base. What a shortstop. Hey, is that your father?
We talked at one point about the Reds renaming themselves the Red Stockings during the 50s. This is why. Avoid the association with communism.
So Les tells Harvey he went to the games with his father.
Oh, and it wasn't him in the infield, huh?
Then Les says it wasn't really his father. It was his stepfather.
I thought of him as my father, and I still do.
Harvey tells Les to relax a bit.
You're a screwed up diner in a pigtail.
Pigtail? You're just baiting me, aren't you?
Harvey's confused at Les's behavior, but he continues combing his hair.
You have any children that you know of?
Harvey tells Les that's a funny joke. Old, but still funny.
Old joke.
Les asks him again.
Oh, I have a boy, but I don't know where he is. I haven't seen him or his mother since he was 1 month old. I bet he's a good-looking kid.
How do you know?
Because I'm his father. You don't laugh at anything, do you?
So let's ask Arby how he knows he hasn't seen him. Maybe he came in for a haircut. Harvey tells him, nah, his kid doesn't live around here. He's in Dayton. Besides, he'd know him. If he came in, he'd know him. Les tells Harvey he's from Dayton, but he moved to Cincinnati.
You came all the way from Cincy for a Harvey Morehouse haircut?
Les has a pained expression on his face.
Mr. Morehouse, why don't you find your son?
Harvey waits a beat or two, then says,
No, he's better off wherever he is. I know that.
Mr. Morehouse.
Look, call me Pops. Everyone does.
Pops. It's funny that's your nickname because...
Wait a minute, let me tell you.
Harvey walks around to look at Les face to face.
When I gave up my son years ago, I did it to save the boy a lot of trouble. Without getting into it, I didn't want any of the things they claimed that I was doing to be put on him. Be terrible to start life ashamed of your own father.
And wow, suddenly things have gotten really heavy. Harvey sniffles, wipes his nose, and looks Les in the eyes.
Any time that I think about finding him, I'll just to kind of say hello, you know? I want to just have to remind myself that I couldn't do the one good thing I did for the boy.
And wow, Bill is stepping in as a guest star, and he's killing it.
It's just amazing to get this kind of performance out of a day player. This is a one-off actor coming in and giving you this kind of emotion.
Oh, he had me in tears.
Yeah, Harvey wipes his eyes, and he removes the cloth from around Les's neck.
Come on, $3.
Les is staring at Harvey again. Harvey looks at Les.
See, you're slipping back into your trance again.
Les stands up, puts his glasses on, and gets a $5 bill from his wallet. He hands it to Harvey. Harvey starts to get him change, but Les tells him to keep it.
Ooh. You can come back anytime.
And did you catch that? Mm-hmm. Ooh. It must be genetic. A 66% tip will bring out an ooh like that.
Les caught it too. He turned around quickly when he heard that.
Yeah.
Les puts on his coat and he gets his hat.
Pops. Will. I'll be back.
Les opens the door and leaves the shop. Harvey looks at the closed door.
Strange kid. Good looking boy. No sense of humor at all.
Harvey turns the volume back up on the radio and we hear a new song. I've Found a New Baby by Benny Goodman and his orchestra.
I've Found a New Baby is considered a jazz standard. It was written by Jack Palmer and Spencer Williams. Clarence Williams' Blue Five first recorded this song in 1926. It's only charted twice, but it's been performed and recorded by everybody. Although Benny Goodman had 164 top 40 hits between 1934 and 1954, this wasn't one of them. Goodman's version of the song is noted for the guitar solo from Charlie Christian. It's considered the best of Christian's career.
You know, Les didn't tell his dad who he was, and I wonder if that was a difficult decision.
Yeah, to not reveal himself. You could tell he wanted to.
I understand why, but...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he wanted to, yes.
Well, and also he's kind of honoring the choice that Harvey made to not interfere in Les's life.
Right.
But yeah, Les really just wanted to jump up and give him a hug.
And now the capper scene. We come back to the studio where Jennifer is sitting on the stool and Venus is behind the mic.
Tenez, vous êtes un petit bourgeois.
Venus is smiling at her. He tells her that sounds beautiful and asks her what it means.
Well, loosely, Renee, in my eyes, you are less than a sniveling worm.
Oh, that's nice.
We hear Remote Control by the Reddings playing over the speaker in the lobby.
So what that shows us is Jennifer can say pretty much anything in French and it's going to sound awesome.
I think anything in French does sound awesome, well, no matter who's speaking.
But then especially Jennifer saying it, you know.
With that voice.
She had Venus mesmerized. She had Herb mesmerized.
But she had Venus ready to have a sex change, remember?
after the episode.
Ask Jennifer.
So we're hearing Remote Control by the Reddings. The Reddings were a soul, funk, and dance group formed by Otis Redding's sons. Dexter was on bass and vocals, and Otis III on guitar. Remote Control was the debut single from the group off their 1980 album, The Awakening. It only peaked at number 89 on the Billboard Hot 100. Although the group would continue to release albums through 1988, this would be their most successful single. And a fun tidbit, if you look up the Reddings on Wikipedia, one of their claims to fame for the song Remote Control is it got sampled on an episode of WKRP.
We hear a noise and we see Johnny's head pop up from under the control board.
You don't seem to agree on who fouled it up, but I think we know who fixed it.
Well, I helped.
Venus asks Johnny if he's ready. Johnny tells him,
of course.
And you know this isn't going to go well. You know it's not.
Venus flips a switch on the control board and sparks fly everywhere. We hear a little surprised squeal from Jennifer as the lights go out and the music stops.
Out in the lobby, we see Art leaving for the day. Just before he reaches the door, he hears static coming from that wall monitor in the lobby. He tries adjusting the knob on the bottom of the speaker, and then he slaps it a couple of times.
Les enters the lobby and says hello to Mr. Carlson as he continues walking toward the door that leads to the bullpen. Mr. Carlson calls out his name and asks him how it went. Les looks at Mr. Carlson and with a smile, he says,
fine.
Oh, good. Real good. Guess I just a little curious. You know, I've even fantasized that my mother wasn't really my mother. That wasn't too bad.
It just dawned on me as these guys are leaving for the day. This entire episode happened in a single day. We found out about Les being denied. We went to the Treasury office. Then Les made a 2-hour drive each way for his haircut and his meeting with Dad. It has been a full day for these guys. So suddenly Johnny comes running out of the hallway leading to the bullpen, followed closely by Jennifer. Johnny comes back with the higher foes. Johnny comes back through with the fire hose from the main hallway.
Hey, wait about 10 seconds and turn it on.
DJs should not be rewiring things.
This is why, right here, fire in the Flim building. And we fade on The Secret of Dayton Heights.
What an emotional roller coaster of an episode.
You're
but
up,
I
you're
loved
down,
it.
You're laughing at things that are just hilarious, but then, wow, the emotion.
I love seeing that part, that side of Les.
Yeah, and also that side of Richard Sanders as an actor, mm-hmm. I think is really cool.
And I loved his dad, Harvey Morehouse. he was great.
Bill McLean, awesome. Just fantastic, perfect guy to bring in for that. He really just occupied that character and did such a great job.
And then, of course, our good old buddy Sam Anderson.
Yeah, anytime you get Sam back, you know it's going to be a fun episode.
Great episode.
And he's going to be hilarious. So that wraps up Secret of Dayton Heights. What is up for next week, Donna?
Out to lunch. Bailey's upset when it seems everyone else has an expense account for lunches except her. Meanwhile, Herb has been having a lot of lunches with clients and having a lot of drinks to help close deals. His drinking gets out of hand.
So another Herb-centric episode, and get ready, kids, a very special episode. So that's going to do it for this episode of the WKRP Cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, make sure to check our show notes. Find us on social media. You can follow our Facebook page at WKRPcast. And for more WKRP fun, become a patron. Go to patreon.com/ WKRPcast for behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and more.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. Write us WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And remember to please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye for now.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!